Judiciary Committee meeting to order. My apologies, we're running several minutes late. It's about 1:37, 1:38, and pleasant good afternoon. Today, the intention for us to work, the thing that we work on is the Senate Joint Resolution Number 2, limiting federal intervention in the management of state resources. My intention today is to hear it, and then for those to consider it and any modifications they want to entertain, give the sponsor a chance to introduce it and go through the issues. Any questions from the committee? Just for me, when I get the full committee here next go around, I will talk a little bit about some of the committee structures. I want you to be prepared to kind of tell me some of the things that you'll see going into the session that you would like to see the judiciary look at. If it's issues that are not necessarily bill related, but you want to bring an issue before the committee. So I'll be talking to the other member that is not here as well, just to, as an organizational issue. So I'm interested in your input. Senate Joint Resolution Number 2, we have Senator Dyson before us. The floor is yours, Senator.
Thank you, and thank you to the committee for hearing this resolution. We're in debt to, we ran a very similar one last session, and several of our colleagues really helped to make it better. And that's a grudging admission, but they were right. The resolution before you is a direct expression of, we believe, the sense of most Alaskans, our elected leadership, concerning federal overreach in the management of Alaska's lands and resources. And I actually was asked by several of my senator colleagues to do this again. All of us, I think, can have to think about what's the purpose of a resolution. And lots of them are so full of sound and fury and signifying almost nothing. But last year I asked Commissioner Sullivan what value was this expression of the legislature, he said that when it gets to court, it's of some value to be able to demonstrate that the people of Alaska back up the decisions of the executive branch. And I can't evaluate that, but I take his word as he said it. It's certainly my desire that we are united behind the executive branch, that what they're doing to protect Alaska's resources, particularly land and land use. And what we're doing here is not only commending this administration, but asking the federal counterparts, Congress and executive branch, to be respectful of our land's rights and our demonstrated ability to take good care of them, be good stewards. During the statehood debate, that was real concern for Congress of how would our state ever be able to afford to support itself. And they recognize, as we all do, that control of our natural resources and commercializing them was the best hope we had. Major force behind statehood discussion, they said, and as a result of that, 100 million acres about was committed to us. And we found out in our hearings in state affairs that all but about 5 million have been conveyed. And I didn't know that, but indeed, then there are all the issues coming out of ANILCA and ANSCA. So that makes this all the more important. We are seeing what I consider to be a very unfortunate federal overreach in controlling development of those sorts of things. For those who would develop and invest in our state, the regulatory process is somewhat unpredictable and a huge hurdle for our developers. That's a huge issue for us. I think Alaska had an admirable record of being good stewards. Our fisheries have prospered by orders of magnitude since the Statehood Act, and I've visited several of the major oil fields of the world, and ours is a example of doing it and doing it right. If you don't believe me, go to the Russian Far East. Last week in State Affairs, we heard that the EPA considers our state a model of how the permitting and development of projects should proceed, and yet we are facing that overreach that I think is very restrictive. You'll notice in your PAC a consortium of Alaska Native Corporations executives who, virtually all of whom, is strongly supporting, I think, what the executive branch is doing and our support thereof. Particularly, I wanted to point out, and the difference between this one and last year is, in addition to the governor's office, Department of Law, Attorney General's office, it also commends the Commissioner of Natural Resources for their efforts. I've said it all.
Any questions? So there are a couple questions that I will ask. First of all, Senator, is there, I wish I had the answer to this question before I asked it, but there are standing committees in Congress that deal with these particular issues. Is there a committee that that we might want to highlight in the copies to in this particular resolution? So I actually asked myself that question. I have not had a chance to research it, but for impact, I'm thinking it would be nice to broaden that. So.
Yep, I think that's very valid. I believe the senator to your right, who worked on staff and a federal Senate, might have some ideas for us.
Well, certainly I think the Energy Committee, lands, I mean, we should look it up, but I agree that you're holding it over.
Yes, I'm going to hold it over. There's a couple things that I had that I would like to question and maybe come up with a couple of suggestions on.
Yeah.
Certainly.
And that would be one of the first ones, is kind of the where to, because in my view, the whereases are our way of making a case, but chances are the therefores, be it resolved, are probably going to be the things they'll read mm-hmm. first. And so who it's going to, and then a couple of the resolved, I thought, there might be ways we could make it more pointed. And so I had a couple of ideas that I haven't got totally fleshed out yet and not ready yet to bring them out, but I thought I talked to some of the committee members and including the sponsor and then bring them out the next meeting. So I like the idea. I think us going to Congress with a resolution brings kind of a unified voice to an issue. And certainly, you know, help us be a state is one of them. Help us to operate as a state mm-hmm. in a union that has the Western states so heavily federally dominated. So,
yep.
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if you're going to do that, then some things, I think it'd be nice to put something in there about, you know, that being one of the premises under which we were granted statehood. That we would be able to develop our own resources, and that would be a part of how we supported ourselves as our population base. So you might consider incorporating that into it as well. And I think that's one of the things that frustrates Alaskans so much, is that, you know, we don't want to be a burden and we shouldn't be a burden, but often it's the federal government that's putting those barriers in place between us developing our own resources that would allow us to be independent.
Also, there might be places that, once again, I'm bringing this up for things for the sponsor to consider and us as a committee. What I heard in your State Affairs Committee was how many times the state actually backed up the federal government on some of its issues, and I think you know, trying to figure out how that might fit in a resolve, not necessarily the whereas, but, you know, anyway, I'm just putting that out as a thought, how we might put that in one of the pointed resolves that they're going to read, I think, more than the history lesson, so much the resolve. So just a thought.
And I agree, and I was pleasantly surprised by that testimony, and perhaps giving them credit for that. would add credibility to our efforts. And if you want, Mr. Chairman, to do that as a committee substitute, or if you'd like this to be a committee resolution as opposed to mine, I'd be happy with all.
And I mean game to either way. I just wanted to bring those forward for things that I was thinking about as I read it the other day, trying to think, what is the best impact we can have on a statement that makes our case, both positively, and I don't mind poking at them, but there are some places where we've actually been helpful to them, and they've been helpful to us, so.
Well taken.
All right. Any other further discussion? I guess I got most of the discussion out of this then. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Dyson. I really appreciate bringing this forward. It's going to be probably, I think, one of the focuses of this 28th legislature is how to best work in the federal system, and this is just one of the statements that will work along the way. Today, we have with us the Department of Corrections, and I asked them if they would come give us an overview. And so we'll start with the commissioner. And Commissioner Schmidt, if you want to come on up and introduce your support base there. And I know this is not the only overview that's been happening in the legislature, but I wanted this time available for us as a committee not only to hear your overview, but kind of apply into some of the things that have been initiated over the last year or so by way of some progress report. Of particular interest to me is the reentry and recidivism issue that I think this committee has dealt with to some degree.
Sure.
And probably none of us here are new to that discussion, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. Update by way of your overview. Commissioner
Excellent.
Schmidt.
Thank you, sir. For the record, Joe Schmidt, Department of Corrections. This is a nice opportunity. In corrections, we don't get a whole lot of opportunity to share with the public. We're buildings are closed and we don't let people out or in very easy, and for us to have a chance to talk about where we are and where we're going is important to us, more so than us talking but listening afterwards and some of the questions that come and are we on the right track. And so that's a question we ask every day. Support network, as you referred to them, Mr. Chairman, doesn't begin to explain the folks that are with me today. Both Carmen and Sam are retired in the last couple of months, and that I had a chance then to kind of re-look at what we're doing. And believing we're on the right path, I think it's time for us to grade, audit, evaluate. We've made a lot of systemic changes over the last 5 years. Classification system, program plan, Goose Creek Correctional Center, all this kind of stuff. And we want to take some time now to make sure that it's all doing what we thought it was going to do. And if something isn't, we'd rather stay ahead of it and tell you that it's not working and what we'd like to do rather than be caught flat-footed and not understand what's, where we're at. So Ron Taylor was promoted to deputy commissioner from director, and he took over the operation function that Sam used to have, and he took Carmen's program and reentry function. So he's a busy man these last few months. Leslie Houston promoted to deputy commissioner. She was our director of admin services, so she is still in charge of all the budget, mental health, medical. But we added to her the grading and audit feature that I was talking about. To replace Leslie back at the office is Kevin Worley, and he was our internal auditor who's now admin service director. So you can kind of see what we did there. We took that mindset and upgraded it a little bit. Casey, of course, is our ledge liaison now, mm-hmm. and she's been working out wonderfully so far. And Mike Matthews is with us today, and Mike is a research analyst by title, but he sits at the table with us, and the data that comes, we brought him today in case there's questions on methodology. How do we get the data that we're presenting to you today, and how do we look at what we're doing, whether it's working or not? An example might be, we know from recidivism studies there's groups of prisoners that don't reoffend as often. A 45-year-old male, for instance, recidivism curves dropped considerably. We put those folks in a program and then say, hey, look how good our program's doing. Well, maybe they would have done well without the program. And unless we specifically ask those questions, we won't know. And we want to stay away from biased data or a perception of biased data. So Mike has been wonderful so far with that. And he's available if there's questions on the hot seat here for him. So as I said, we want to grade and measure. We want to make sure that our systems are working that we put in place. When I first became commissioner, one of the first documents that I saw was a recidivism study from the Judicial Council, and that was January of 2007 when that came out. As a new commissioner, that was a very fortuitous time to get that document because that was our roadmap. I learned quickly that 95% of the people in our system get out of jail in their lifetime, and we need to pay attention to what we're releasing, and that's going to be through change. That's prevention, of course, is better. If we could prevent the crime in the first place, obviously that's the best thing. I think recidivism is a way of preventing the next crime, and so it's a prevention effort, and I think it's one of the most important things we can do. A couple of the things that Ron is going to go over, some of the changes made. We upgraded our classification system, and we tended to overclassify in the past. And what the new system does, it took the group, our in custody classifications are minimum, medium, close, and maximum. We had an oversized group of close people and an undersized group of medium people. And so when we looked at the other state's classification system against ours and we upgraded it, we saw a switch in our population. And Ron's going to go into that a little bit. We have a bigger group of medium offenders now and a smaller group of close offenders. We were comfortable with that change because medium offenders are still in secure facilities.
Senator Dyson has a question on that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Would you explain the difference in those categories?
Oh, sure. The minimum offender is one who may be getting close to the end of his time. His behavior is such that halfway house placement, possibly furlough, electronic monitoring, these kinds of things. Medium custody offender. When someone starts, many times people think if they committed murder, they're automatically max. It doesn't necessarily work that way. Our system is based on behavior and time. And factoring in the crime, of course, at the beginning, the old system tended to take something that happened that you can never change, like your crime or your age, for instance, and that was a negative mark against you. It would score against you basically forever. There is no way to change that. So what we emphasize now is how they're doing. Are they programming? Are they making a change? Are they trying? You could have a first-time DWI who's problematic enough and score max custody, and you could have a murderer who is behaving himself, and he may not be. So anyways, that's kind of the way we're going with that. So I'm sorry.
Does that satisfy you, Senator?
Yeah, there was four, minimum and max, and there was two in between.
Yes, sir, through the chair.
Medium and close.
To Senator, medium and close.
What's the difference between medium, close, and close?
It's a scoring matrix, and I can't tell you specifically because it changes with the offender. But when your behavior is more dangerous, you're gonna be more towards the close or max. Max, we have about 60 or 70 in the whole state that are max custody. So,
So in those classifications, are you looking at the danger to your guards, staff, and other prisoners?
Yes, sir. Through the chair to Senator Dyson, it's danger. Period. Obviously, it's going to be towards other prisoners or officers.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Commissioner.
A couple of things. I need to give Ron the time today, so I'd hope to just go over a couple quick what the department looks like today, and he's going to go over some trends and some things that we're seeing. In a nutshell, though, last year we did 40,000 bookings, Department of Corrections statewide. We're a unified system, of course. So that's misdemeanors, felons, sentenced, unsentenced. When they come in, we had 40,340 bookings. However, 22,000 unique individuals. So that wasn't 40,000 Alaskans coming to jail. That was 22,000 Alaskans coming to jail, many of them multiple times. Just under 2,000 of those were Title 47s, if that's of interest. That's the inebriate on the street who may freeze to death, and we had just about 2,000 of those statewide. So just under 6,000 offenders in prison, halfway house, or half.
Before you go on, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that, which communities are putting people in jail for being drunk on the street or for being homeless or what?
Oh, yes, sir. Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski. Title 47 is not a criminal charge. It's not a criminal. But they, like I say, there's almost 2,000 a year. Last we looked at it, my dad is a couple years old now, but it was almost equal thirds. Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Bethel had almost equal numbers of...
It's all civil-related, true.
And they're treated like prisoners?
They are, yes, through the chair. It's they're 12-hour hold. We can't hold them more than 12 hours, and if they sober up between then, we can let them out. If someone comes to pick them up, we can let them out. So there's quite a difference.
Senator Wilkowski.
Are they booked as prisoners? Are they fingerprinted mugshots, things like that?
Yeah, everybody that comes in is I'm stumbling with the with the fingerprints. We take a picture of everybody, and we have a booking process for everybody, but it's not a criminal commitment, so.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So where are we? Okay, we have just a little less than 6,000 offenders in the prisons, in the facilities, in the halfway houses, or the electronic monitoring program, and just a little more than 6,000 offenders out on probation or parole. One other stat I thought I would talk to you about real quick, and Ron's going to go over it in more detail later, is the what is the recidivism for the folks that program? And again, the caveat is the folks that program. General recidivism is 66% without a program plan. And what we've been measuring for the first time in recent history is the folks that don't come back to jail instead of just the ones that do. And we've got the capacity for about 1,000 people to go through substance abuse program now. And our sample group, Mike is here to correct me if I'm astray, somewhere between 750 and 850 people was the test group that he looked at. And recidivism is down 14%. It's at close to the 50% range. So we could, of course, say, well, 50% of these people come back to jail, but it's not 66%. And so we're very encouraged by that. Obviously, we're pouring deeper into it, but the initial numbers are looking very good for us. So.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
So is that on the people that you're doing the drug program for, or is that overall you're down by 14-15%?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, that's just the people that programmed. That test group was about 800. So, yes, sir. Okay. With that, if there's no questions, if I could have Mr. Taylor take the...
Sure.
Okay. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Taylor, come on up. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ron Taylor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. The Commissioner was doing such an excellent job, I thought he was going to continue and finish out the presentation. If you can turn to page 4, that's where we'll start at. This, as the Commissioner was talking about a few minutes ago, became the impetus for all of the changes that started occurring in the Department of Corrections. And what I'd like to highlight on page 4 is a couple of things. First, 48% of the persons that were coming back on new crimes or technical violations within a one-year period of time. Now, when you initially look at this, it's concerning because you have such a high rate of return. In fact, almost more than 50% that are actually coming back. But look down at the six-month period of time. And that's where we do have 50%. And what we're trying to do is look at programs and look at the way that our system is designed to move that further out so that less and less of our persons are coming back through our system within the 6 months and 12-month time period and push that out as far as possible. So how did we get here? If we look at page 5, the increase in costs. Our overall budget for DOC increased from a 2005 number of $167 million to over $323 million in 2013. We are all familiar with the Goose Creek Correctional Center and the cost to construct that at about $250 million with an annual cost of $51 million a year. And if you look at our daily cost of incarceration, that's actually increased from $110 per inmate in 2005 to well over $147 in 2013. And if you look at our medical...
Senator Dyson, you had a question on that?
Yeah, I had two. does the rate of incarceration closely track the rate of increase in population in the state? I would guess it does, but...
I'd hate to venture to guess on that one through the chair, okay. Senator Dyson, yep. But we can get that information for you.
It's all right. Secondly, during that period, how much has personnel costs increased?
We'll get the budget information for you through the chair, Senator Dyson, and so that you can see that.
So the period of time you're talking about is what was said here, 2005 to 13?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back a slide on the recidivism rates, do we have any updated numbers? This is dated, well, it's about 6 years old at this point. Do we have updated numbers on what the recidivism rates are?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, no, sir, not yet. This was a study that the Judicial Council actually did back in 2007. So no updated data on that.
Any idea when we might see some, to see whether or not what we're doing is working or not?
Through the chair, I'm not sure, Senator Wilkowski.
You know, according to what the commissioner said, you know, a reset time. So as you folks go through this discussion, I think we'd be interested to know what you come up with as a methodology and what we might expect going into the next year or two.
Thank you, sir. And the last part was about the medical costs increasing in Anchorage. They've almost doubled in the past decade from 56.2% compared to the national average over that same time period of 29.8%.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, quick question. Forgive my ignorance, but for those guys who are in jail, for their medical costs, do you get Medicaid, Medicare funds?
Through the chair, I think that that's something that we're actually trying to work on.
Yeah, interesting one. But does somebody that's incarcerated presently not qualify? Is there some federal law? Let the record reflect.
The commissioner no.
Shook his head.
Behind me?
He's giving me dirty looks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski also has a question.
Just follow up on that question. I think that's an important question to know. There's some debate right now about whether or not Alaska should accept the Medicaid expansion, and I'd be curious to know if that would impact corrections costs at all, if that would mean more money coming into the state, or how that would impact the state.
Through Chair Senator Wilkowski, we can get that information to you.
Thank you.
All right,
yeah,
thank you.
Just give it to the chair, and I'll make sure that the committee gets it.
Thank you, sir. Our next slide looks at our overall population growth and what we project over the next few years up to 2020. And as you continue to look at the graph itself, it shows that based on a 3% growth rate, we would be looking at a new prison about the time of 2016. And so what we're trying to do is look at what programming, what resources that we can put into effect that would actually bend that curve and allow us to go further out before we would need to build a new prison. Also contributing.
Before we go on, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Just what's the plan at this point? We're 2013 now. We're looking in a couple of years. We're going to be some fairly significant shortage of beds. I mean, are we looking at shipping people back to Arizona or Colorado or building another prison? What's the planning at this point?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't think we're looking at shortages right at the moment in 2013, but certainly we're looking to bring people back from Colorado. And so by the first quarter of the next fiscal year, we should have most, if not all, of the persons that were down in Colorado, except for the few that we will have out for protective custody and other reasons, that they would remain out regardless of the contract in state.
Right, except if you go out to just 5 years from now, you're looking, actually 4 years from now, you're looking at shortages. And what's the plan for 3, 4, 5 years from now? I mean, because it takes a while to build a new prison, right?
Through the chair, that's correct. It does take a while to build a prison. But what we're putting into effect is the programming and some of the resources that should actually take that out further than just 2016. That was projected based on when we did this in 2011, 2012, and that was just giving the public an idea of as we continue to increase at the same growth rate, what would happen, and we're beginning to slow that down now, sir.
So the expectation is that programmatic approach would bend that curve down?
That is correct, sir. So also what we're looking at is higher probation violations from 2002 to 2010. Even though our probation caseload has increased about 20%, what we're also seeing is our jail admissions has also increased during this time period from 1,641 jail admissions to over 2,700. And in 2011, for example, when we looked at all of our probationers that were on probation and parole, about half of them had a petition to revoke probation that was filed in their case. Most of those were for technical violations. And so one of the big things that we're going to be focusing on in our probation and parole is how do we do a better job of dealing with our technical violations as we move forward.
Senator Bilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you define technical violations? What, can you give us some examples?
Any non-legal violations such as missed appointment with the probation parole office, substance abuse testing, that they missed their testing, or test positive for a UA. Those are some examples.
And once again, you would start looking at kind of a programmatic approach to, rather than putting them in jail, putting them under a different kind of accountability?
That's correct, sir. And Mr. Chair, as we continue to go through, I'll explain what we're okay. looking at in terms of our current direction.
Thank you.
On page 8, we're looking at also an increase in our nonviolent population. So what we've actually seen is from December 2002, which is the slide on your left, to December 2012, we've actually seen our nonviolent population increase. This is pretty consistent to what we're seeing nationally, although what I would say is Alaska's increase in nonviolent population has been much more profound than across the nation.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, Ron. Am I right in assuming that many of those are substance abuse, the nonviolence?
That's through the chair, Senator Dyson, I would say more drug than just alcohol, but it is substance related.
And when you say nonviolent, I suspect that there was no assault involved, but how about accidents, like drunk driving and hitting somebody or such?
Through the chair, if that was as an accident, I'm sorry, as an assault, if it was charged as an assault, it would not be here.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. As I said a few seconds ago, there's more drugs and alcohol that are in our system now. You see, you should have a current slide. Oh, I'm sorry. Nope, this is correct. I'm thinking of the next slide. But in this current slide here from 2002 to 2011, what we're actually seeing is an increase in drugs in our system. From 2003 to 2012, misconduct involving controlled substance. It wasn't back in 2003. In the second degree, it wasn't even part of our top 20. Mm-hmm. Now it's one of our top 20 categories. Our offenses in 2012, and we've seen that almost double over the past 9 or 10 years. The next slide is the one.
Excuse me, just
sure. Senator Dyson.
What does transportation mean in this context? The light green.
I would have to, through the chair, I'd have to get that that definition.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir. On our next slide, you should have the most updated version of the percent of offenders by length of stay from admission. Looking, comparing 2002 to 2012, and that'll actually replace page 10. And what we want to draw your attention to was that there more people are staying in custody longer, and it seems to be coming from the 7 to 12 month time period where there's a reduction, well over 10%, to an increase in our 37 months or more. So people are coming in, our nonviolent people are coming into custody, but they're staying at a much longer rate.
So, Ron.
Yes, sir.
This is just nonviolent, this particular pie stretch? Or is this violent and nonviolent?
Mr. Chair, this is all of our persons in custody.
But the expectation, Ron, is that 37 months or more is growing as a big portion of nonviolent?
I'm sure we can get that number for you, Mr. Chair, whether it's just exclusive to nonviolent or both nonviolent and violent.
All right. Okay.
So what did we do as a department in terms of how has our philosophy changed? What are we looking at? And if you look on page 11, there's three principles of effective correctional intervention that the department has actually been following for several years. And what this principle actually does is it changes from what we're doing right now, risk control strategy, to a risk, need, and responsivity principle. So the risk is who are we targeting? And what we should be doing is targeting our time, energy, and resources to our moderate and high risk cases versus what we may have been doing in the past in terms of focusing on lower risk cases. The need factor, it's the what? Identify those criminogenic needs that, if we were able to change them, would contribute to them not continuing their criminal behavior. And the responsivity principle, which is the how. In other words, we should be focusing our conditions, our programming, our referrals, and our supervision strategies on those persons with the need that we've identified, so that we can reduce the likelihood of continued criminal behavior.
Senator Dyson, did you have something on that?
Yeah, I didn't want to get ahead of you here. Do you have any sense of what are the effective or most effective programs or interventions?
We're going to be covering some of the programs. Through the chair, we're going to be covering some of the programs here in a few minutes.
Jump ahead.
Yep.
As usual.
Visionary.
So what we're actually doing is we're moving from custody and monitoring to looking at behavior change. From where, as an agency, feeling like we're the only one involved in the business of reducing recidivism, to understanding that we play a bigger part and we have to collaborate with others in order to make sure that that recidivism rate is going down. From looking at unproven methods to using what works. From measuring just simply inputs to measuring true outcomes so that we're improving those who are under our care. And turning our focus from offender failure so that we're focusing more on offender success so that we do a better job of improving public safety. So how do we assess risk? On page 13, you'll see where the department has changed the classification policies, and as I said a few minutes ago, that's to encourage behavior incentives. That's to encourage persons to participate in programming rather than just sitting in a cell. So everything in terms of property and how they're moving down in classification is related to our behavior incentives. We also have developed an offender reentry policy that actually has an offender management plan to provide a roadmap for the prisoner to determine what programs are needed and to provide a means of ensuring that that person is getting most, if not all, of the needs met while in custody for our long-term felons. And in the probation and parole arena, what we've done is we've received technical assistance from the National Institute of Corrections so that we can look at ways that we can improve our system and also make sure that it's in alignment with the rest of the department in terms of risk, need, and responsivity.
Just a question on that, Ron. As you assess this, I like several of the things here. There's a kind of an accountability and assessment period and what programs are needed. For those of us who get to deal with several parts of the budget, there's another part of the budget that says these programs are needed, but quite often we don't see this kind of an assessment on how it's going to fit. So from your perspective, what I'd like to hear is here's what the program needs are, but we have an access or a programmatic blank spot here. So as you're doing these risk assessments or the programmatic assessment needs, if it's not available anywhere in your community, some of us need to know about that. So, just for what it's worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, as we start talking a little bit more about the rehabilitative programs, maybe we can cover some of that. Mm-hmm. So if you look at page 14, then, when we changed our custody risk level, the commissioner talked about how it reflects more of nationally where we should be in terms of our minimum population at 44%, which includes our electronic monitoring, our furloughs, and our halfway house beds, our median population at 35%, and then our close max population around 16%, which is close to the national average. On our probation and parole side, when we actually looked at changing our system, one of the things that we were doing and what we learned on the probation and parole side was we had modeled our classification system and our risk level based on an institutional level. So we were at minimum, medium, and maximum, and we weren't utilizing the full capability of the LSIR, which is the level of service inventory, the tool that would actually tell us this is where a person scores out at. And so what we did was take a hard look at all of the LSIR scores that we had done in our system over the past year. And we looked at where would it be right now if we really modeled our system based on best practices and looking at that LSIR model and moving that forward. And what we begin to see is that about 60% of what we were doing was over-supervising. And what I mean by that is we were seeing some of our lower people much more frequently than we should have been seeing them. Our high-risk persons may not have been seen as much as they should have been seen. And so what troubled us was the inconsistency that we were seeing throughout the state. Mm-hmm. So what we've tried to do is bring that back to say, here's what our model really should look like, where low moderate to moderate is where the bulk of our probationers and parolees are. And in doing that, how can we do a better job at making sure that those low moderate and moderate persons that have been screened through our probation system have either received services while they were in custody or when they get out of custody, that we are targeting those needs such as substance abuse and other programming. What I think you're going to find out as we continue to implement this type of system is that it's going to have an effect on how we are actually supervising people in our community.
It almost shifts to the 80-20 rule, doesn't it, where 80% of your population could be managed by 20% of your group from the looks of it. But it's probably going to be it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out.
Yes, sir.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just looking at this, comparing slide 7, we've got, looks like, 2,755 probation violations, 68% of which are for technical violations. It's a huge reason we have the recidivism rates that we do. It seems like that's an area where we really need to focus on. Can you talk about some of the specifics that you're doing to try to address that? Are we... I mean, obviously, we want to keep these people who are out on a tight leash, but, you know, are there changes? Are there things that other states are doing that we can learn from so that we can stop having 2,755 people getting thrown back in jail for probation violations, 68% of which are technical?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, you bring up an excellent point. You bring up the point that when I took over last year as the division director and started looking at this, there were two major areas that we started focusing in on. One was this one in terms of the LSI and how we were actually assessing, and the other was the back end in terms of who are we violating and why are we violating. And was there any, or is there any consistency in how people are being violated in Anchorage versus Kodiak and elsewhere? And again, with our assessment process, we also have begun to see that there's some inconsistency on how we do that. But along with that, what we're learning as part of our technical assistance is it's going to require more than just the probation parole office to be involved in this. And so we've been reaching out already with the parole board and court to look at conditions, for example, in terms of saying, do we really need 50 conditions on this person to supervise this person effectively. How can we do a better job of narrowing down or zeroing in on those conditions and tying that back to the criminogenic needs that these persons have when they're on supervision? So we're beginning to look at conditions. We're also, as the chair mentioned earlier, alternative sanctions. What things can we do other than just say go back to jail? Are there ways that we can build some intermediate sanctions and alternative sanctions that the court and the parole board are accepting of? We're really in the preliminary discussions with that portion of it, but you've hit on one of our big areas that we're going to have to redesign here in the future.
Senator Dason?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate your work in these issues. And you're wisely, I saw here, encouraging people to not go associate with the same bunch of folks that they were involved with before. So do you have the authority to, on a person that's being released, to put a bracelet or anklet on them and tell them you can't go to this area, you know, where... You know, you and I know where most of the drug deals go down, and you know, and so on and so forth, and areas the hookers work. But can you exclude them from those areas? And if so, it seems like many of the low rent or affordable housing is often around where the crimes may have committed or so on. Help me.
Through the chairman, Senator Dyson, we don't have that authority to basically, once they're on supervision, also put them on an ankle monitoring and do both that unless the board has ordered it or the court has ordered it as part of a violation. If they were serving their initial sentence, the department obviously could give them an opportunity to serve part of that time on electronic monitoring, depending on the type of case it was.
Yeah. Probably a little bit beyond your job and mine, but it'd be interesting to hear a debate on those two sides of it. I mean, you can certainly think about the personal liberties purview, but you're trying to get people into less expensive, less restrictive, more transition things.
Through the chair, you're exactly right. I think one of the things that we've struggled with as a system and we're starting to come together on is it's not just an institutional problem. It's not just a probation and parole problem. And it's not just a community problem. All of us have to be working together to ensure that when that person comes through our doors in the institution, how can we do a better job of moving them through the system and onto the natural community, peer, and family supports that are already there, and putting that in a positive way more so than letting them go back to a place where it's going to be real negative and bring them back into our system again. So that's what we're trying to do with our whole approach here. How do we make sure that that person is not coming back through our system?
I just might follow up. I think for all of us, if you figure out better ways of doing it, and particularly where other jurisdictions are doing it better, and it requires a statute change or court rules or something, let us help, but you got to figure out what the right thing to do is. Thank you.
Senator.
Thank you, McGuire.
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, it's interesting because at the federal level, it is the case that upon release for at least one full year, felons are not allowed to associate with any other felon. And it's interesting because it's something I have thought about at the state level. Whether that would be worthwhile. It's controversial for sure, but there's just so much evidence that breaking that, you know, peer group association is critical, as Senator Dyson has said, to moving on. And then number two, I just wanted to point out there's a company in Anchorage that I went to take a tour this summer called Alaska Pretrial Services.
Yes, ma'am.
And I assume you're familiar with it, but really innovative stuff that this guy is doing. In terms of electronic monitoring, and he was showing us in this tour that we went on, where we could actually see people you know, on a monitor when they were getting outside or near offenders, you know, homes. That in some cases that was part of the condition of their release, that they weren't allowed to be within a certain distance of the victim's home, other things. Anyway, I encourage you to use that kind of technology as much as possible.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, your first point dealing with antisocial companions, for example, there are restrictions through the board, parole board, or the court that prohibits those persons who are on probation or parole from associating with other felons. What I believe that Senator Dyson was talking about was also putting an electronic bracelet on them to restrict the areas where they are.
Yeah.
So, but for the record, there are, we do have those restrictions on our probationers and parolees that must be approved by a probation officer or the court or parole board before they can associate with a given person. The second thing that you were mentioning, it sounds like what you're talking about with Alaska Pretrial Services is an active GPS system that they have,
yeah.
And as a department, we've opted to go with a passive GPS system so that, one, it's a staffing issue, and then, two, it's a cost issue.
We'll probably hear more about it. Senator Dyson, you had something to add?
Yeah, I was going to inform Senator McGuire that in the last couple of years, these folks have done an immense amount more with electronic monitoring. Explain to me, sir, what the difference between passive and active is and what the delta is cost is, or?
In terms of, through the chair, Senator Dyson, the active versus passive is where, as Senator McGuire was saying, actively you could see where a person was and
right.
what they were doing, and you could be able to monitor
yep.
and respond 24/7.
Yes.
Passive, they'd have to download through a phone modem, and we'd get that information probably the next day, and then we'd be able to respond based on that.
I'm sorry. I missed something. Who dials?
The when the offender is hooked up in terms of the modem that they have to have in their house as part of the passive system that we have for them, we are able to download that information back in Colorado, I believe, is who our contract is with.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and before this session, we'll probably delve into that a little more because I know that, for example, on the active system, at present, mostly paid for by the offender, mm-hmm. is what I understand. And so it'll be an interesting discussion, especially when it comes time to scrutinize your budget and they want to cut even more into your budget. It's going to be an interesting conversation. But that goes to kind of the question on programs and what the state may or may not be able to reimburse on. So, I mean, the whole thing has to be looked at as we move forward. So, but what you're doing as far as kind of getting the data to us is going to be important. I have a feeling, though, this data is going to not help us much this session. So you're going to have to help us what is going to be on the action list as we get into this next budget cycle, basically.
Thank you, sir. So on page 16, you've already started dealing into some of the criminogenic factors that we're looking at, such as antisocial values, companions, looking at antisocial personality or temperament, being able to refer people to anger management programs or programs that would help them deal with stress and difficulties in their lives, family or marital issues, finding ways to reduce conflict and build positive relationships. Next page deals with substance abuse, employment, education, and then the leisure and our recreation. That these are all factors that we're looking at as part of a program design for an individual to address these needs so that we lessen the likelihood of them returning into our system.
Excuse me, Ron. Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Do you have a way of sorting or analyzing these folks for mental health problems? I'm thinking particularly of autistic and fetal alcohol spectrum stuff.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we are doing that. We have a whole behavioral health unit that specializes in the mental health and the medical issues in custody.
Yeah, so then you must have a way that you're dealing specially with the folks like fetal alcohol, you know, that no behavioral health is going to change the wiring diagram they've got. So do you have some way of housing those people different or treating them differently?
I'm unsure, through the chair, I'm unsure of that right at the moment, Senator Dyson, but I can check on that for you.
Well, it's a very difficult to assess and so on. Don't spend any effort on it. We can come back to it next year.
Thank you, sir.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, same goes, I'd love to hear a follow-up on traumatic brain injury. A similar issue with respect to behavioral, you know, manifestations that are associated with that and how you treat it. And then the other point I just want to make as well, I've made it in other hearings when we've talked about this. It's great to see how far you guys have come with this. It's really very exciting. So I'm really grateful to see the shift in resources to those that really need the resources placed on them. But in your behavioral unit, I hope there'll be consideration too for applications for drugs. And what I mean by that is Wellbutrin, you know, the antidepressants, Topamax, some of these things that are on the market that actually change the molecular structure in the brain when it comes to addictions. And I've said this on the record, but I'll say it again as a doctor's daughter, that some of it is about changing behavior, but some of it truly is chemical in the way that people are wired genetically. And I just think we need to continue to have that discussion in a state where we have the, you know, number one, we're always number one for addictive behaviors and things like that, that certainly within the population we have it. And I hope that's a part of what we do.
Hey, thank you, Senator McGuire, through the chair. Page 18, looking at how we have now expanded our rehabilitative programming. And as the commissioner talked about in terms of our substance abuse program, we've looked at that substance abuse cohort and we've compared our completions, those who are actually going through and completing our substance abuse programming with those that are not completing. And that's where we're getting the 14% recidivism that the commissioner talked about earlier. You see where we've actually expanded the capacity for our outpatient program, which is our LSAT, and our RSAT program, which is an intensive residential program, and our aftercare services have all been expanded within the last couple of years. In terms of our adult basic education and our vocational programming, we actually have numbers that we've served. Our vocational programs range from small engine repairs to a list that we'll be more than happy to provide you with in terms of the programming at each institution. While we don't have actual data on this yet, what I can tell you, though, that the vocational educational programs nationally have been known to reduce recidivism by 8.3%. And so as we continue to build our performance management, our audit, and our grading unit, hopefully we'll be able to come up with those numbers for you so that we can see how we're comparing nationally.
So just a question on that, Ron. I'll go down to the vocational education because that seems to be the largest number. Those tend to, my guess is, they would be job-ready type qualifications. The barriers to go into work, if you're a felon, there are barriers. If you're a misdemeanor, there are barriers. So how many of these fall into the felon and how many into the misdemeanor? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, no. I would have no way of knowing. I know that there are 492 different barriers that are associated with are persons in custody who have a felony or misdemeanor, but actually how many would prohibit them from participating in this program, I don't believe I have that information for you.
It's something that you might want to think about, because as we look in this committee at the various different methods and means to get people into productive life, felons have a bigger hurdle than misdemeanors, and yet misdemeanors seem to be your biggest recidivism issue. And so it, for us, as we listen to kind of these programmatic approaches that you're dealing with, the best we can understand that, we might be able to be more helpful to you. So,
thank you, sir.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we move forward, I would just like to encourage you to the greatest extent possible, keep track of this information, keep track of the data, how successful we are with these programs. We've, in the last 6 years, I've been on judiciary, I know Senator McGuire has been as well, Senator Cogdill's been on for a while. The data is so important to us as policymakers, just at least to me, trying to figure out what, you know, I'm happy to give you money if we're going to save money down the line. So I would just encourage you to, you know, to the greatest extent possible, keep track of that information for us and provide it back to us.
Through the chair, thank you, sir.
And Senator Dyson also.
Yeah. All the years I've been in this building, I've kept bothering these people about job training. In particular, prison industries.
Yeah.
You know, I suspect all of us think that productive work is very therapeutic. But part of the answer that I've gotten is they've been so short of beds, you know, that they're literally playing musical beds. And the commissioner has told me that not being able to have people in a permanent place for some years and sort them according to both their criminal status and their things that would be helpful for them to reentry has been a real problem. And my limited experience tells me that misdemeanants who are going to be there for a relatively short period of time, it's less possible to have them fill a, in essence, vocational apprenticeship and so on. But so there's been real practical problems. We all hope that Goose Creek and, mm-hmm. you know, will be a huge part of solving the people moving all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we're probably asking the same questions you folks ask yourselves going down this road, but as we look for solutions to help you with, that's why we're asking.
Thank you, sir. So let's shift gears just a second to our PACE program, give you an update on what we're doing there. As you're well aware, the PACE program was actually implemented, started in Anchorage back in July of 2010 with 70 high-risk felony probationers. The Alaska Judicial Council actually did a preliminary evaluation on the program that showed that those who were actually participating in PACE, it actually appeared to be successful at reducing positive drug tests. From 66% of probationers that were free of any positive drug tests during their first 3 months, and when you compare that to their first, before they were enrolled in PACE, it was only 20% of those persons that were free of a positive drug test. PACE has now expanded into our Palmer area, and then we have a misdemeanor DV PACE program that's operating in Fairbanks.
So just a question on PACE. Ron, we had heard this, and we're pleased to hear the quick accountability, clear accountability. So from the time of the need for accountability to implementation, you know, are you satisfied with the timing of that? How did the probation from the time of notice of infraction to the time of quick action take place? How are we doing?
Mr. Chair, we are actually doing pretty well. We have an excellent partnership with Anchorage Police Department, and the actual committee for PACE meets on a pretty regular basis to sort out those issues, mm-hmm. and so we're doing a pretty good job on that.
So it was a pilot program now being expanded, probationers drawn into it voluntarily or assigned to it?
They're assigned to it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
And then if I can, I'll just go over the Prisoner Reentry Task Force.
Sure, thank you.
And the purpose of the task force is to reduce Alaska's recidivism rate and improve public safety and the overall health of our Alaskan communities. Right now, we have three formal work groups. As you mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, the misdemeanor work group, which is really focusing in on how do we deal with that high recidivism of misdemeanors, where it's very difficult to do programming or very difficult to do something for a short-term person. And so we have a work group that are looking at ways that we can come up with resources, come up with ideas and strategies to be more effective with the misdemeanor population. A substance abuse work group that has been very instrumental in helping identify where our gaps are in substance abuse services and what we need to do in terms of aftercare, our community programming, and we've been doing a good job working with them on that. And in our employment work group, where we've worked with the Department of Labor and have a phenomenal relationship with them in terms of the apprenticeship programs, as Senator Dyson mentioned earlier, that we're beginning to expand and look at other ways that we can work with them to ensure that at least the employment barrier is not a barrier when that person is released from custody. And we also have established some regional reentry coalitions, and those coalitions are designed to look on a community level at what are the real problems in each individual community. And as you can imagine, housing is one, employment is another one, and certainly access to resources such as substance abuse. Those are things that each of these communities, Anchorage, Kenai, the Mat-Su Valley, Dillingham, and even Juneau, have been tackling over the past few months. And we're having some very good results in terms of participation. I think one of the things that surprised me was last year at the end of the year when we did a reentry fair in Anchorage. And I went to that fair thinking we'd have a few people show up here and there, and left with the impression of the huge need that reentry is something that we're just barely scratching the surface on, and that we really need to look at ways that we can do a better job of providing that community peer support and family support for our probationers and parolees and those guys that are being released from custody.
Right. Senator Dyson has a question, comment.
I really appreciate what the department has done, working like with people like the Mary Magdalene House, you know, that provide transitional housing from. And also the what appears to be a very open door to various faith-based organizations. I know several women are spending a lot of time at the Eagle River prison, you know, building friendships and those trends, friendships and even housing and jobs and mentoring go on afterwards. And I was impressed when we visited the Transitional Living Center at Palmer.
Yes, sir.
And I remember when we were driving in, the guard asked us, where are you going? And we told him, and he said, man, those guys are easy to deal with and don't come back very often, which I thought was excellent. And by the way, there was a smart aleck prisoner there, gave me a comb with no teeth. Tell him I still have it.
So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have for you today.
Well, thank you. You can hear kind of the questions that we're looking for. We know that you're asking for the same question, kind of answers the same questions we're looking for. But in order for us to help, and there are some places where I think we need to step in. For one, on the task force issues, I'll be watching very clearly on some of the things. I think you're going to see some issues coming forward on whatever barriers are to reentry. So. Some are very significant, some are fairly modest, so you know, we'll be entertaining them here in this committee. We have some minutes left. Is there anything else from your department that you'd like for us to go over? Maybe the commissioner has something else.
Thank you, sir. I'll switch with the commissioner. What do you need?
All right. Well, thank you, Ron. Well, before
I
we
ask
go,
you a question, and I don't think I got the answer. And that was the difference in cost between the active and passive
monitoring?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I actually get you the cost on that. I will get that.
Okay.
It will be more expensive, obviously, with an active versus a passive system.
Yeah, I just want to know if it's a factor of two or three or whatever. And then some, I don't like the idea of you guys not having the very best that can be done if it makes a significant difference in the effectiveness and right. That cost-benefit ratio. But anyways, thank you.
I think that's a key element, and that is effectiveness. Certainly, the most expensive could be the most effective, but is it, percentage more effective than, a half, third the cost? I don't know. So it would be nice to have a perspective on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Ron, thank you very much. And thank you for taking the responsibility on. Commissioner, we're running you pretty tight here. Is there anything else that you have before?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to come and do this and talk a little bit publicly about where we're going. The questions were very pointed and very relevant. Right. And you're right, we are asking ourselves a lot of these. We'll probably call traffic something else. It's a citation type. We'll get a little deeper into that. But I think the comments about data are right on the money, and we're going to that's what we're working towards. So,
and I'm sorry we didn't drill down into some of the methodology. There might have been places where we could have drilled down into that.
Sure.
But there was questions that we're going to be looking for. I'll go back and probably bring them back up for the committee as we go.
Sure.
Also on monitoring. Not only is the your finance budgets committee going to hear some of those things, mm-hmm. but we're looking for whatever effective ways we can put in some policy calls, and we will be dealing with a variety of different policy calls, from your misdemeanors to your felons, okay. on reentry. So my expectation, we'll probably have that discussion again. So I'll try to get that information before the committee as it's relevant to the issue before us, so this is not lost. So that will be my commitment to the committee. Senator Wilcox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the drugs, it'd be interesting to see if you have a breakdown of the drug offenses, whether those are for trafficking or possession or and what kind of drugs. I think that'd be sort of interesting for us or helpful.
Sure. I think through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, we'll up until recently we've said it's a Mike's is a Mike's, and we don't know what it was. If it was marijuana or cocaine. Mike might be able to pour in a little deeper than that. And as an overview, I think this is right. I feel very good about today. I think we've got a lot of information out there, and it's a short amount of time, but gives everybody something to think about. We come back to another hearing with maybe a more specific focus. We could bring. We'd be proud to have Mike talk to you about what we have available to us. And what we would need if we wanted more available to us, and how we're looking at what data we can capture and that we cannot. So,
right. And I am very sympathetic to the fact that whatever comes through the court system ends up at your door, mm-hmm. and then it's a matter of how do we best serve our community at large to those who can be most productive, mm-hmm. probably the least likely to reoffend. How can we help them not go back to jail? And then how do we keep those who are, honest to goodness, a problem to the public safety, how do we keep them in good order?
Yes, sir.
And I know that you had a new prison come on this year, and so that's probably dominated a chunk of your time.
It has.
But, for us, the universe of possible programs that you have available to you is still something that is a little bit of a mystery to us, because we get to hear the health and social services side say one thing, and mostly juvenile justice, but in many other programmatics, but many of them fly right over our heads and go into grants in communities that we have a hard time making a sense of, but they end up at your door. So that's why I asked the questions I did earlier.
Agree. Thank you.
I just might add, for the benefit of the senators here, we saw a chart here that shows us we're going to need another Goose Bay facility in 7 or 8 years, which has got to be scary. And so what do you do about that? Mm-hmm. And many of us have been enamored with the PACE program, which I think originated in Hawaii.
Yes.
And has been quite successful there. And there's a piece of it. There's also the
several has been involved with, including particularly Senator Ellis, with the whole thing of smart sentencing. Mm-hmm. And that can have a significant impact on the population. Mm-hmm. And there's some of us that think that people, perhaps on you and I's side of the philosophical spectrum, have beat our chests and said what we need to do is tougher prescriptive sentencing that I think have incarcerated more people for longer than was appropriate and taken away from the judges as the prerogative. And then we have over-criminalized and made felonies out of some crimes that shouldn't be felonies. And then we have the issue of felons never being able to get that off their record with the loss of hope. And mm-hmm. I think these people are certainly working on their part of that problem, but there are others in our criminal law and the judicial system that we ought to all be paying attention to.
And for what it's worth, I know that you are definitely a reactive institution. And so I appreciate you have to react to everything that kind of comes your way, from what society dishes up at the reentry level mm-hmm. to those who come to you because they have gone through a court system with very little control from your part. So very reactive. But I wanted to lay out kind of the scope so that when we're dealing with the other policy calls, we have that well set in our head,
sure.
What some of the needs are. So thank you very much. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and my apologies. I wanted to thank the Sex Trafficking Task Force. This is their last day. They're getting their recommendations ready to come to us, and that was a part of a bill I worked on, so I wanted to thank them. But so my apologies for stepping out. But I want to join in saying thank you to you for your leadership. And I was one of those people that was skeptical of Goose Creek, as you know.
Yeah.
And I was delighted to really hear Senator Dyson's words today and to think a little bit more about that, the chance for Alaska to have its own corrections system.
Yeah.
And to really have a chance to focus and, you know, separate out offenders and to understand our prison population. You know, who are they?
Yes.
What are the issues that are out there? And I've said this statement every single year, and it's been now 13 years that I've been on the Judiciary Committee in the House and the Senate, and I say it, and so I just want to say it again, and this is what I think is forefront in all of our minds, that unless you're sentencing somebody to death, which we don't have the death penalty thankfully in Alaska, these people will come out and live among us,
mm-hmm.
next door to us. They'll go to our churches, they'll go to our schools, they'll be in our grocery stores. They're human beings. And we want to rehabilitate them.
Yep.
That is one of the tenets of a good criminal system and a good society. And I want to be proud of that system that we have in Alaska. And so I thank you for this is, in my opinion, one of the most meaningful moves forward that I've ever seen from the Department of Corrections. So I congratulate you on that.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Certainly the capacity for rehabilitation resides within the individual. There's no doubt about it. We just want to give them every opportunity we can. And from my perspective, I always have a very sympathetic eye to those who have been offended.
Yes.
And so as we go through this discussion, I will continually remind ourselves that many people have been offended
mm-hmm.
who don't have the opportunity for many, many resources that we will be put into those who have otherwise offended. So I'm just very sympathetic to that. So. Thank you very much for your time, Commissioner, and for those of you who came before the committee, we'll look for a long and further discussion throughout the year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn this Judiciary Committee.